Dear students, it is time to skewer the culture of consumption scandal number one in the United States of America, and that is cars. 500 years from now, when the history of the United States is written for the 20th century, it will be all about our love affair of the motor vehicle. 500 years from now, when the history of the 21st century is written, I hope it will have something about how we turned around the car culture, and who knows what technology is coming down the pike. Hopefully someday nobody will own a car. You'll just, when you need to get somewhere, there will be something that will take you there immediately. Well, we'll find out. We'll see. It's happening now. So. And as I said, I'm going to insult everybody by the end of this semester, so if you're a big car fan, I apologize in advance, but it's time to take your lumps. On this slide, number 44, is a link to a video that was done by a governmental agency in Australia, because they had a huge problem. They are the smallest state in Australia, and they had the highest per capita deaths from car accidents. And their culture of drinking was very strong. And so they started tackling it in 1989. Right. And then 20 years later, they did they went back and looked at how they had done, and they had lowered the per capita deaths in half. They had cut it in half. But still, there was still a lot of deaths, and so they're continuing to do this, and it won awards from all over the world, and it's pretty raw, folks. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's very, very graphic, but in my humble opinion, we do not treat drunk driving as seriously as we say we do. We say we treat it that seriously, but still, there's just too many people driving drunk on the road. But that's, you know, just one of many scandals when we discuss cars. So let's get started on the Chapter 6 appendix, Buying and Operating Motor Vehicles. Or as I would have titled it, You Are Not What You Drive. Or are you? Well, it depends on who you are. I know some people, oh my goodness, I wouldn't be caught dead in a Ford or a Toyota. I have to have a big money waster. I'm sorry, break my wallet. Beautiful Mexican women, big BMW, right? I have to have a BMW or a Mercedes-Benz or whatever. Because, dear students, the number two item on your cash flow statement in terms of size is most likely to be your car. Indeed. And as we saw back in chapter one, when we started putting money away into a Roth IRA or whatever investment, it seemed like a lot of money over 30, 40 years, but it's far less than what most people in the United States of America will spend on their motor vehicles. So, are you what you drive? I hope not, but, you know, it's your decision. Cars are a very personal decision. Slide number 46. Let's start with some statistics. According to the Department of Transportation, the percentage of short motor vehicle trips consists of 49% that are 3 miles or less. 3 miles. Now, to you and many other Americans, 3 miles seems like a long, long way. But you can walk 3 miles in, you know, less than an hour, 45 minutes, depends. Some people faster, and they add, 'cause I ride my bike to work sometimes, not as much as I used to. I'm getting older, but they'll say, oh my goodness, I could never ride my bike. I live 3 miles from work. I say, you can walk. What? Are you serious? Yes. If you do that 2-3 times a week, you walk to work 3 miles, 45 minutes in the morning, 50 minutes in the afternoon. You won't have to go to the gym anymore to do your cardiovascular exercises. You will have already done all the cardio that you need throughout the week. Indeed. 2 miles, 40%. And a full one quarter of motor vehicle trips are 1 mile or less. That's, a lot of them are just people bringing their kids to work, to school in the morning, as they sit in the back of the sport utility land barge drinking soda. Yes, exercise, dear students. The average American uses as much energy as 3 Japanese, 13 Chinese, 153 Bangladeshis, and 499 Ethiopians. Gas mileage usually decreases rapidly at speeds above 50 miles an hour. You can assume that each 5 mile per hour you drive over 50 miles per hour is like paying an additional 16 cents per gallon of gas. And this is according to the rate of fueleconomy.gov. Which is actually a great resource that nobody uses because they don't want to go 55 on the freeway. They want to do 75. Okay. Stuff. What? Let's. Okay. I know some people get a little upset and don't believe in science, but that's their decision. But let's do the chemistry here. For every 1 gallon of gas you burn, how much carbon dioxide do you pump into the atmosphere? Is it 7 pounds, 15 pounds, 20 pounds, or 125 pounds? Well, now wait a minute. How much is a pound? How much is 1 gallon of gas? It's about a pound. And if you're familiar with liquids, pretty much all liquids, a gallon weighs about a pound. Every liquid is different, but that's about right. So you burn 7 pounds of gasoline, and you get 20 pounds of carbon dioxide. Wait, that doesn't make any sense. Well, actually, the chemistry is real, dear students. You're taking octane. There it is. That's what octane is. You take 8 carbons with a bunch of hydrogens around them in a line, and you mix them with oxygen, and poof, they burn, they ignite, and you wind up with water. Water, right. If you look at the back of a car as it's leaving, just started off, you'll see a little bit of water coming out of the pipe, only when it just started, because within a few minutes it will all be vaporized into steam, and carbon dioxide. And what's the problem here? You're swapping the hydrogens, which is the lightest element that's around the carbon, with oxygen, which is 16 times heavier than hydrogen. That's how you can wind up with 20 pounds of carbon dioxide from 1 pound of, 7 pounds of octane of gasoline. And this formula is not balanced. Take it to your chemistry professor, because I did it once a long time ago and I can't remember how to do it again, but your chemistry professor will do it in seconds, okay? How much oil do we import? Do we import oil? Oh, yes, we do. Is it 12%, 24%, 40%, or 66% of our oil? Well, dear students, we are awesome. The United States of America is, we take ourselves for granted. But for almost 2 decades, without any kind of, formal energy policy, because the government, the Republicans and the demagogues couldn't agree, they couldn't play nice in the sandbox, we were importing fully 2/3 of our oil. And then the industry said, this is ridiculous, we got to do something about this. And that's when they came up with fracking. I wish they would have come up with a better name for it, because it doesn't sound very good. But we have increased our oil production to the point where now we're only importing 24% of our oil. This is a very big thing, dear students. It flies under the radar. We don't hear about it that often, but there are tremendous consequences of this. One of them is that the Saudis got pretty upset and lowered the price because they have a huge spigot, and that has put that whole possibility of us being energy independent in jeopardy now. But still, we have come a long, long way. So how much is that per person per year? In other words, how much is each man, woman, and child in the United States spending on imported oil? Is it $260, $409, $859, and $2,240? Well, we are down to $260 per person per year that we write a check. Every man, woman, and child writes a check for $260 and sends it abroad. But just 2008, we were up to $2,240. That's when we were still importing 66% of our oil, and the price of oil had spiked at $147 a barrel. So think about it. We were writing a check for $2,240. Briefly, not didn't not last very long, because then the price plummeted when the supply came online to meet the demand and meet that price. But still, that's a it's a huge difference. And so what has happened? What has happened? Let's see. 260 per person per year multiplied by 330 million people. That's approximately 86 billion, 135 billion, 283 billion, or 672 billion. Well, dear students, it's down to 86 billion. You see, we were sending almost half a trillion dollars over, I'm sorry, over half a trillion dollars, because in 2008 it was $670 billion. We were sending that dollars outside the United States. And now we're not. Now we're only sending $86 billion, which still is a lot of money, but it's a lot less than it was. And what has happened because of that? Well, the dollar has appreciated significantly. Yes, it has, which has made it really great for those of us who go traveling abroad, because our dollar buys a whole lot more than it used to. And we don't hear too much about this. We do not hear that much about how we have reduced our foreign dependency on oil. But it is really has put a crimp on some countries, Venezuela indeed, which was Hugo Chavez has now passed away, but he was using those petrochemical dollars, mostly many from the United States, to fund his little socialist agenda, and now they're in trouble. Right, exactly, now they're in trouble. And by the way, we're one of the few countries that can actually handle their crude. It's not, as they say, light, sweet crude. what a name. Yes, so how many barrels of oil do each of us consume each year? 42 gallons. It's about 21.5. Every man, woman, and child in the United States consumes 21.5 barrels of crude oil. And I forget exactly how many. It's 42 gallons. I forget. It doesn't translate one for one. It makes more gallons of gasoline, but still, it's a significant sum of money. We are addicted to oil. We must. You know, what's the first step in learning how to deal with your addiction is to become aware of it. And we, in 1970, when people drove around in their living rooms with large bench seats in the front, consumed about 26.3 barrels. In 1978, before the second gas crisis, the second oil shock, we were up to 31. And then 1979 came along, and most of you weren't alive then, but I was, and I remember lines of 1.5 miles for people waiting to get gas. And I was riding my bike to work, and I passed my boss, Dr. Richardson, on my bicycle as he was sitting in his Corvette waiting to get gas, reading the newspaper, and I yelled out, "Hi, Dr. Richardson!" And he said, "Frank." Within days, the company I worked for, the conference room filled with bicycles. And all of a sudden, I became an instant celebrity, because they were all asking me how to do this and how to do that, and how do you keep your pants from getting oil on them, and how do you fix a flat. And then the price of oil hit a dollar a gallon. you young folks, what? And all of a sudden, there was plenty of oil, and the conference room emptied, and there was one bicycle left that was mine. And look at what we did. Look, if you don't believe me, just type it into any search engine, 1979 oil crisis, oil shock, and you will see lines of cars a mile long waiting to get gas. And look at what we did. This is how powerful we are, folks. This is how powerful we are. We went from 31 barrels per person in 5 years down to 23.7, because people stopped driving around in their living rooms. But then oil became plentiful again, and oil went back down to a dollar a gallon, and people were like, ooh. And sure enough, we started driving around our living rooms again, but this time with minivans and sport utility land barges. And by 2007, before the next crises, the 2008 housing crisis, we were up to 25.4. And for years, public policymakers, environmentalists speculated on what price per gallon would people finally stop buying sport utility land barges, and the answer came in 2008. Once gas rose above $4.50 per gallon, SUV sales plummeted, people drove less. They did. And then the Great Recession hit us, and SUVs just disappeared. But now they've come back. They're not the same SUVs. They're not trucks anymore. They're basically cars, but the mini SUVs, or whatever you want to call them, they're not the same as the Hummer, right? They're just not this. They get much better gas mileage, and they're not the same. So let's now discuss cars as if we're going to buy a car, and let's stop pontificating on the evils. I mean, the problems, the characteristics of car driving in the United States of America. Which do you prefer? New or used car? What are the pros and cons? Well, in the face-to-face class, we try to get people to start talking about, I like a new car. I like that new car smell. It's really good for my lungs and brain cells. And I don't want to deal with the maintenance issues. Used car. I like a used car. It's a lot cheaper, especially if you buy one that's only about 3 or 4 years. Cars these days are really much, much more reliable. Check Consumer Reports. And so I'm going to not take the huge hit of depreciation. So it's you. You have to decide. Let's take a look at a used car. Well, there are three sources: new car dealers, used car dealers, and private parties. Folks, new car dealers often make more money off of their used cars than they do off of their new cars. So you have some serious bargaining power if you go to a new car dealer. Used car dealers get a very bad reputation, but they usually treat you better than a private party. With a private party, you're going to get the best price, but you have literally no recourse. My advice is to consult Consumer Reports. And in the face-to-face class, we show the reliability statistics that pass around the magazine. It's the April issue. And you can look at the buyer's guide, the yearly buyer's guide at the library, or, you know, subscribe. I think it's $24 a year still. And it's a great magazine. You got to be careful. Sometimes they do screwy things when they test their items. But when it comes to cars, they really do a good job of testing the cars. And they have the reliability statistics that the industry sometimes tries to say, it's not true. No. They survey tens of thousands of people around the country, and the truth is out, folks. The Japanese have the best reliability. The Koreans have done very well lately. The American cars are much better than they were, Chrysler being the exception. And it's funny, the German cars, because they've become so sophisticated, their reliability has actually suffered. It's mostly because of all the incredible sophistication they have in their vehicles. But still, the statistics aren't telling us the untruth. They're not telling us a lie. You're going to have more problems with an American or a German car, Fiat Chrysler being the worst, than you are going to have it with a Japanese or a Korean car. But cars are much more reliable than they used to be. How do you inspect a used car? Well, my advice is to find an honest mechanic, pay for an inspection, because it is, for us older gentlemen, difficult for our ego, folks. It's a blow to our self-esteem when you open up the hood of a car and you can't even find the engine. All you can see is this big black thing of plastic. You can't find the starter motor. You can't see where the spark plugs are. The cars have become so sophisticated that, yes, you need to be always being educated. Mechanics are always going to classes and taking online classes to learn about the vehicles, because they're so complicated. In fact, BMW has this support group that for their mechanics. Because we got a tough one for you here, folks. I've fixed this thing 4 times and it's still because of the complexity. So find an honest mechanic, pay for inspection, expect to pay upwards of $100. Yeah. Where do you get the price information sources? Well, Edmunds, NADA, the National Association of Dealers, National American Dealers Association, and Kelley Blue Book all tout their information sources. But my personal favorite is just look on Craigslist. And if you are like me, not much of a car fan, I really don't like cars. I use them. I must admit, I'm a car user, but I'd much prefer to be on my bicycle. I like to consult a friend who is a car enthusiast. I have a friend who just loves cars. I mean, he's got one of these old Mustangs with the convertible that people come up to him and want to buy it every time he goes out with it. And he's got another vehicle that's really slick. He's actually a driver for Uber. And he loves to drive. He loves cars. So I ask him, and he's helped me buy vehicles. Yes, yeah, so there you go. Find somebody who's a car nut, and they can help you buy a good used car. All right, so now let's take a look at new cars. Very quickly, folks, you gotta be careful. The car companies are not stupid. They know all about the buying process because they study us, the consumer, like we study a bug under a microscope. Over half of all new vehicle purchases now involve some internet interaction. From gathering in to information to actual purchasing, the average cost of a new vehicle now exceeds $30,000, folks. If you don't believe me, ask the Federal Trade Commission. Do not be swayed by advertising. Remember the media. You can keep the car, but I will take the bubble-headed bleach blonde with the... They try to use sex to sell their cars, and it works. 20% gone. What does that mean, 20% gone? Well, the average new car, some more, some less, as soon as you drive it off the lot, bingo, you've lost 20%. So if you bought a $30,000 car, which is the average price for a vehicle, as soon as you drive it off the lot, it's now worth $24,000. Right. What an expensive 5-minute drive, indeed. Taking it home is the most expensive drive you'll ever make, because now it's worth 20% less. Mm-hmm. So think about it, folks. Don't be swayed by the advertising. Do your research. The service contract. The dealerships are going to try to get you to buy a service contract. Unless the car you want, you have to have that Fiat or that Jeep or that VW that's not very reliable. You've checked Consumer Reports, right? My advice is to stay away from these things. You might even be told that a service contract is required by the leasing company. It's not. These things are basically insurance policies, and they're not stupid. They know the reliability statistics, and they know the chances of you actually having a serious problem. And so they price it accordingly to make sure they make plenty of money. This is very lucrative for the dealerships if they sell these things. Because what's going to happen? Once they have the sale, they're going to put you in a little interrogation room with bright, garish lights. A greasy little man with bad breath, bad teeth, and the smell of cheap cigars will then work you over, trying to get you to agree to purchase a service contract, undercoating, upholstery spray, as well as a timeshare in Cancun. You tell them if they try to put you in that little interrogation room, you are going to leave immediately without buying. And they will go, okay, no problem, we understand. We don't have to play the game with you because you don't want to play this game with us. We will make the sale and not worry about making extra, few hundred dollars off a service contract or selling you $12 of upholstery spray for $395.95. Yes, slide 59. How do you negotiate the price? Well, some people love haggling. They love to get in there. Others would rather eat barbed wire. So you might want to bring a friend who's a good bargainer with you. I have done this for individuals, and I absolutely adore it because I love the process. and you'll hear them say, well, what about our cost? And you say, you don't understand. I'm the buyer. I worry about the price. You're the seller. You worry about the cost. If you can't supply this vehicle at this price that we're interested in, fine, just tell us so. And we'll take our business. You see, that's the most your strongest negotiating tool you have are your 2 feet. As soon as you start walking off the lot, you will be surprised at how well they want to negotiate. You can actually know the dealer's cost by consulting Consumer Reports or Edmunds or Kiplinger's. And what they will also tell you, and this is something you should know if you're going into the negotiation process, is that the dealer's cost really isn't the dealer's cost. What? What's going on? You see, they have what are called factory incentives. If they sell certain number of cars within a month, then they get a rebate. They basically actually pay less for what the cost of the car is because they get a rebate. And at the end of the month, often the dealers are scrambling to make that quota, that incentive amount. So you can often get tremendous deals if you just wait until the end of the month. Or you could go through one of these car buying services. Most all credit unions, because that's their lifeblood, folks, car loans. Credit unions love car loans. They have car buying services, and they can negotiate a very good deal for you. So check them out, indeed, if you're the kind of person who does not want to do the negotiation. How do you finance it? Well, in an ideal world, we'd pay cash for our cars. And people think, are you crazy? I say, well, I do, because I like to buy a used car that's, lost much of the depreciation. But if you have to finance it, then check out your credit union. It's almost always going to be a better deal than the dealer financing. Why? Because often the dealers make good money off of that financing. Or they're going to offer you a really sweet deal, very low interest rate, but you know what? You don't get to take advantage of the $2,000 rebate on the new car. So my advice, go to a credit union, get pre-approved, and I just hate it. I love Mission Federal, excuse me, don't get me wrong, but every 3 months or so they send us something in the mail saying, you're pre-approved for a $500,000 car loan. I'm sorry, $50,000. There's no way I'm spending $50,000 on a car. I'm going to spend $50,000 on something I can live in, maybe, but not something I'm going to just drive around. And as soon as I take it off the lot, it'll be worth $40,000. Wrong. But then again, as I said, I'm a very different individual than others who want that new car smell, and it's good for their lungs and brain cells. Upside down equity means that your car is worth less than you still owe on the car loan. It's called negative equity. That's like an oxymoron, like jumbo shrimp. Remember, 20% gone? If I bought that $50,000 car with only 10% down, that means I owe $45,000, but as soon as I drive it off the lot, it's now worth $40,000. So if I got an accident, the insurance company would want to pay me $40,000 because that's what the fair market value is, and that's why almost always now your insurance company will discuss GAP, Guaranteed Asset Protection Insurance, and we'll discuss this in Chapter 8 when we get to home and auto insurance. And often the credit union will advise you, and so let's talk about GAP insurance for those of you who have to have a new car and wind up owing more than the car is worth as soon as you drive it off the lot. Leasing a vehicle. This is even worse. It depends, dear students. Leasing a vehicle is a fancy word for renting a car. The advantages is that in the short term, there's a smaller cash outflow, lower monthly payments in buying, and many businesses love leasing because of the certain tax advantages they have. And if the business goes under, they just give the car back. But the disadvantage is that you never own the vehicle. And if you drive it, more than the 10,000 or 12,000 miles they give you every year, you're going to get hit with a, depending on how much you drive it over the mount, a big bill when you give it back. Or if you've had excessive wear, and who decides what's excessive? The bottom line for leasing a vehicle is that you are almost always guaranteed to spend far more over the long term leasing rather than buying. My advice, for what it's worth, because everyone is different, is if you're the kind of person who has to have a new car every 2 or 3 years, I mean, you just, that is your priority. That is the value you place on having, on your life, is to have a new car every 2 or 3 years, you might as well lease. Because you're going to spend a ton of money either way, buying or leasing, if you have a new car every 2 or 3 years. You might as well not deal with the issue of having to trade it in and getting really destroyed on the trade-in value, or trying to sell it yourself. You're going to spend a lot of money either way. You might as well, if you're that kind of person, you might as well not have to deal with the getting rid of the old car that you own and buying a new car. However, you see, the cool thing is, for these people, thank you very much, who have to lease a vehicle and have to have a new car every 2 or 3 years, this is an excellent opportunity for us cheapskates. I mean, for us used car buyers, because the value of cars plummets in 3 years, typically 50%, some more. And so let's say somebody leased a $45,000 sport utility tank. I'm sorry, Landbar. Gas guzzler. Sport utility, SUV, a sport utility vehicle. They leased a $45,000 Lincoln Navigator, right. And so the expected residual value after 3 years in the lease end value, was $32,000. So what they're going to try to do is they're going to say, hey, the person brings it back after 3 years, and they're going to say, hey, would you like to buy it for $32,000? And the leasee is going to say, no, that's why I lease. I want a new sport utility land barge. And so the leasing company now has to get rid of the vehicle. Exactly. And they're lucky. They're going to be lucky if they can get $22,000, $23,000 for it, because 50% down after 3 years. So you can drive a pretty good bargain, no pun intended, and pick it up for $20,000. And in general, leased vehicles are treated better by the lessees, the people who rent them, because they know they have to bring it back, and if there's any excessive wear and tear, they're going to get hit with a bill. This has worked for certainly many individuals. It's worked for us and my family. A leased vehicle that was 3 years old that had been driven 10,000 miles almost 30,000 miles after 3 years, in almost immaculate condition, and for 50% what you would buy it new. Pretty darn amazing. But again, you're not going to get that new car smell, which is really good for your lungs and brain cells. Or better yet, buy a new EconoBox, like a Honda Fit or a Toyota Yaris. No, you would never get caught dead in one of those little things. I don't know. I think they're pretty nice. That's up to you. For $16,000. So what kind of vehicle? I pontificated long enough. Now let's decide what kind of vehicle we want. According to our authoritative and detailed scientific research, we have found that the larger the motor vehicle, A, the smaller the IQ of the driver, or is it B, the more fragile the ego of the driver, or C, is it the greater the sense of powerlessness within and anger toward the society around them, or is it D, the more microscopic the reproductive organ? No, it's A, it's all of the above. I am sorry. I told you I'm going to insult everybody. I can't believe why some of these vehicles are 8,000 pounds. You got a 200-pound person, 150-pound person being carried around by an 8,000-pound Ford Extinction. But, so I apologize. My sincerest apologies to you folks with the Explorer. Not really. I have a great story. And I got this idea from a woman, actually. This was many years ago. And I was working as a computer programmer down near downtown. And we walked to a restaurant. And as we left, now we got to set the stage here. There's all guys, because we're computer nerds, and one nerdette. And all the guys just simply adored her. She was a very good programmer. She was very sharp. But the guys, I always told women, get into the computer field. You'll be outnumbered 12 to 1. You'll always have dates. Maybe it's a curse. I don't know. But as we're leaving the parking lot, walking back, this guy in this huge, I forget what it was. It was some kind of big SUV with huge tires, comes out of the parking lot, squeals the tires, and, you know, just announcing to the world how big he is and come look at me. And as we're walking, the woman made this comment about his size of his reproductive organ. And we all looked at her, and the one guy says, "I have a Honda Civic." And I said, "I have a Toyota Tercel." And we all laughed. So that's where I got the idea from, folks. So it wasn't out of my sick brain. It was somebody else's sick brain. Slide number 64. What are the costs of operating a car? Well, there are several, and you should check the link here on slide 64, because the AAA is their bread and butter, is to know how much it costs people to drive, because that's what they sell that information. And the fixed costs, no matter how often you drive or how much you drive, are the depreciation, the interest on the loan, the finance charge, the insurance, and then the license, registration, and taxes. The variable costs are gas and oil, tires, maintenance and repairs, and tolls and parking. And in the face-to-face class now, we would do a little exercise. It's on the website. You check to see what you think the costs are, rate them from 1 to 7, and then you actually take a look at what they are. So check that out. And check out the before. Don't peek at the answers. Put down what you think are the rating. What is the most expensive items? What's the least expensive items? And what it costs actually to operate a vehicle? And you'll be, I think, surprised at the results. I think it tends to you hear gas when people look at the actual costs. So, according to the AAA, what is the average cost per mile to own and operate a new medium-sized sedan, you know, a Chevy Impala, Toyota Camry, a Honda Accord? Is it 12.5 cents, 25.8, 40.9, 57.1? In 2016, 57.1 cents. Oh, 57.1 cents. So if you drive an average of 15,000 miles per year, that's over $8,000, folks. And many people have two cars. So you're looking at $17,000. People just do not realize that cars are killing us financially. They're draining our lifeblood. And so when there are vehicles that are available to you, and all you have to do is just type in your cell phone or your computer, come pick me up at 8:30 and take me here, and it's going to cost you, one-third what you're paying now, maybe one-half, maybe less, depending on when you go. Obviously, if you want to go at the most peak hour, it's going to cost more. I think the driverless cars that people not owning a car, just using the service when they need it, I think it's going to explode. Personally, we'll see. Wait 10, 15 years, 20 years and see what it looks like then. Because we're looking at, if you have two cars for 40 years and you have to have a new car, you're looking at $685,000. Remember we said putting $150,000 away after 30 years? Yeah, well, cars cost a lot more. Back in the early 1980s, a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Pond, I thought he would have retired by now, but he's still active. He's a great writer, financial writer, and speaker. He did a study where if you bought a new car every 4 years versus buying a new car every 10 years and investing the savings, and this includes the cost of maintenance, and cars were not as reliable as they are now. They're more reliable now. At the end of 40 years, his study showed you would have had $350,000. Those were 1980 dollars, folks. Double it or more for now. My advice is to buy a reliable new or better yet used car and run it into the ground. But everyone's different. I remember my Toyota Tercel that I adored. I did not want to get rid of it. My wife, my boss at the brokerage firm, my mechanic were all telling me, you got to get rid of this car. I said, can't we just fix it up? And my mechanic, who's a dear sweet man, and I'll give you a referral, he's tremendous, he said, Frank, you're going to spend $2,000-$3,000 and it's still going to be worth maybe $400 or $500. Okay, all right. So I sold it for a pizza. And they never did register it. I got a thing in the mail saying, come pick up your car. We've put lots of tickets on it, and it's going to be towed in or was towed or someplace. I wrote back and said, no, it's not my car. Here's the bill of sale. I sent it to the DMV. Forbes says the number is closer to $12,000, but I think they concentrate on luxury cars. And, of course, when you look at the AAA brochure, you'll see that luxury cars are more expensive per mile, economy cars are cheaper per mile, so they're just looking at the average mid-size sedan, they call it, Chevy Impala, Honda Accord, Toyota Camry, what else? Ford Fusion, yeah. Slide 67, servicing your car. You and I can't service the car anymore. Forget it. Find an honest mechanic. Stay loyal to them. As I said, I have a referral for an excellent mechanic. He's awesome. I trust him. It's like finding a good doctor, a good lawyer. Cars are so sophisticated now that you need somebody who has the expertise to work on them. So, what's the bottom line on cars? In my humble opinion, go get a bicycle. It's healthier. Get a scooter. It's motorcycle. They're more dangerous, but they are certainly much more efficient. It's a 300-pound vehicle driving around a 150-pound person instead of a 5,000-pound vehicle. Get training! You think you know how to ride a bike, get training from the San Diego County Bicycle Coalition. The link's on my website. They're an awesome group. If you get a motorcycle or scooter, get training from the CHP-approved training. It's awesome. I took it 1 million years ago. I'm sure it's even better now. I have over 58,000 miles on my commuting bicycles, which at 57 cents, 58 cents per mile is over $35,000. But the more importantly, when I started riding again, because I stopped riding for several years, I was a paunchy 30-something male suffering from sedentary lifestyle disease. Now I'm just paunchy. But it really did help my health. It really helped my health because of the cardiovascular exercise. And if you can walk to work, even better, 3 miles. Don't forget the savings to the environment, which are difficult to estimate, and many people don't want to think about that, but they exist. And it is so much fun to ride past people stuck in traffic in their cars as they're driving to the gym. Coming up Otay Lakes Road, there used to be, it's not there anymore, but it used to be a gym right before you get to the top, coming up towards the college from Bonita Road. And there would be people trying to get into the gym. The parking lot was full, and I'm riding past them on my bike. I just had such a kick out of that. And traffic's only going to get worse, I think. The statistics certainly show it. And so let's see. Let's hope for the future and find a time when we don't need to own cars anymore. Okay, all right. Those of you who love cars can throw arrows and slings at me, whatever you want. But I think, though, I think the 21st century, we're going to change the world in great ways. And I mean, be honest. Don't you hate sitting in a car and the traffic? I mean, come on. Tell me the truth. You know, don't lie. Don't lie to yourself. Don't lie to me. Cars kill us with kindness. If we got out on our bicycles, got out walking, not only would we save money, help the environment, we'd also be healthier. All right, enough preaching. See ya.